Hey everyone, welcome back to the Maximum Gain Podcast. I am your host, Arya. This is a super, super special episode. The second episode of the interview series on the Maximum Gain Podcast. I don't know. I mean, like, I was stoked to get Sahil Makhija on the first episode, alright? I was so stoked to get him. If you haven't checked that episode out, check it out. It was such a fun one to do. But this one, in particular, today's episode is something that I was honestly very nervous about doing. Very, very nervous about doing. Today's guest is Bruce Falconer. Now, let me just quickly give you a little understanding. Let me give you a little lesson on who Bruce Falconer is. Now, I hope you all have watched anime, right? There are a lot of great animes out there. Lot of great ones, and there is one that truly became known as one of the most popular, or perhaps the most popular anime of all time. Maybe just except for Pokemon. Aside from Pokemon, another anime that is honestly world-renowned for its amazing action sequences. To this day, some of the best action sequences you'll ever get in film or television. This anime was Dragon Ball Z. The one and only Dragon Ball Z. I remember watching this show daily since I was 6 or 7 years old. I watched it a lot with my brother. And we just loved this show. I remember Advait and I would nonstop try to collect. First of all, back then, it was very hard to try to find Dragon Ball Z on CD and stuff. So wherever we could, we'd somehow get some bootlegs or whatever it was of Dragon Ball Z, and we'd watch them together. And I remember we watched the Funimation dub of Dragon Ball Z, which is the most known dub, the most known English dub at least. This one premiered worldwide, honestly, this version, worldwide. And it wasn't only like redubbed, but the music was redone. And I have to say, the soundtrack to Dragon Ball Z is the soundtrack that made me want to get into music. In one way or the other, just get into music, compose in particular. And the person behind the music of this show is Bruce Falconer. He not only, now see, the whole, like, he has a production house. It's Falconer Productions. That production house, he has other engineers and all working for him and a few other composers as well. So it's not just him. Let me just state that right now. It's not just him. There was a full team. But he was the creative head. And he would let stuff pass. And he would, you know, he would guide the show's musical journey. All the characters. Especially this show was honestly ridiculously intricate in terms of which character themes should be used for which scene. There were many times where you'd have, obviously, you'd, first of all, with Dragon Ball Z, there are a billion characters. Literally, there are a billion characters, and all of them are so memorable, not only because of the artwork and just the writing of the characters, but the music that would accompany each and every one of these characters. So Falconer would write certain themes specifically meant for a character in this mood, you know. So when Vegeta was angry, this theme would be used. Or when he was powering up, this theme would be used. Honestly, there are close to 70 hours worth of music made for Dragon Ball Z. I'm serious. Close to 70 hours. Can you imagine how much work went into this for that much music to be made? And Dragon Ball Z is this kind of show that, honestly, if you mute it and watch it without the music, it is really not as captivating. It really isn't. I've tried watching the Japanese version, or rather, the other English dub version. There's this other version where it's English dubbed, but they kept the Japanese music. Honestly, it doesn't, it just doesn't work as well as Falconer's version. Falconer's music is absolutely sublime for Dragon Ball Z. And so basically, this is the thing that he is most known for, Dragon Ball Z. And even today, he's invited to cons like KameaCon and so many other cons. KameaCon, by the way, is the official Dragon Ball Z con. Bruce Falconer is constantly invited to that, or he's invited to other Comic-Cons and stuff like that, because, well, he worked on Dragon Ball Z for like 8-9 years. He's not only done that, which is, you know, the biggest thing, but he's also done a lot of other projects before it and after it. A lot of TV projects before it. We talk about that in this episode a lot. We talk about a lot of projects he's done after Dragon Ball Z and stuff he's currently working on, including something that's gotten me so hyped, which is his latest project, Dragon Amnesty, which is kind of a tribute to his fans that he's done through a Kickstarter. And he's actually composed music kind of in the same vein of Dragon Ball Z, and he's done that all by himself during the lockdown period. So we talk about that and just so many more things, including some interesting questions about hobbies and about his personal life that might get give you better insight into who he is as a person. So, as usual, check out my Instagram handle, Arya_Guy, that's Arya_Guy, for clips of this episode and many other episodes and a lot of updates on the show itself. You'll get an episode of Maximum Gain Podcast every Friday, and it'll be available everywhere to stream, wherever you're listening to it right now. It's available here, as well as numerous other platforms like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Deezer, Gaana, all the major ones, you know. So feel free to check them all out. Feel free to follow me on all of it, because you'll get an episode every week and you don't want to miss particularly the episodes where I interview people and topically speaking. Those are kind of my most viewed ones right now, so you might want to check those out. Without wasting any more time, let's move on to the main section of this episode, which is the interview with the one and only Bruce Falconer. Very nice to meet you, finally. So, I just want to thank you for doing this interview. Really means a lot to me. Shall we start?
Sure.
Yeah. All right. So, Bruce, so yeah, everyone knows, you know, mainly like what your most revered work is, which is Dragon Ball Z. But on top of that, you've done so much more work. And so I wanted to kind of delve deeper into the work that you had done before Dragon Ball Z. And then we had, and then we get into, you know, the fan favorite DBZ questions.
Okay.
So.
And there's an after as well. So I've done.
Yeah, there is an after.
Music after.
Of course, yes, there is definitely an after. I've compiled a bunch of questions to really balance the mix.
I started composing when I was 10 years old, so I've been composing 10. A long time.
Wow, okay. Yeah, no, so, yeah, I wanted to ask, first of all, are you speaking from Cake Mix Studios?
Yes, you can see behind me is the acoustic wall in the back of the control room.
Right, okay. I just wanted to ask, actually, I was a little confused. Is Cake Mix Studios separate from Falconer Productions, right?
Cake Mix Recording Studio is my studio that Falconer Productions Music is the head of. So I started out with Falconer Productions Music, and when I wanted to do a recording studio, I wanted everybody to feel invited to come and record their music, because it's a beautiful facility. It's to my right over here is a huge recording room that can accommodate a small chamber orchestra if you want.
Oh, wow.
Or a medium choir. Band performances can be in there, and they can all play at the same time. And there's separate rooms for isolating like the drums and the bass and the guitars and the singer. And when we did the orchestra, we isolated the operatic singer from the orchestra itself. And so I had two mixes going when I do that. Cake Mix is just part of my company. In my creative room in the front office where I write music, the acoustics are not as pristine as they are in these rooms, because these rooms are dedicated to recording. And right. In creating, I didn't need the pristine acoustics. I can just get by with okay acoustics where it's quiet and I'm not getting disturbed. And I have all my samplers and my my computers that record my performances. Well, using MIDI, but I consider it as a recording format that you can manipulate. Whereas when I'm in here with Pro Tools, it's definitely a pure recording. A little bit harder to manipulate if you needed to move something a little bit because the sample was not to your liking as to where it attacked.
Yeah, I had recently also you had upgraded your studio entirely.
Yes, I did. I now have Pro Tools Matrix with 24 tracks of their pristine microphone preamplifiers, and it's phenomenal. Of course, my piano concerto I'm working on has about 48. It has over 48 tracks on it. So I'm still only seeing part of it.
Yeah.
But when you're doing a symphony orchestra and a piano in a concerto format, it's pretty huge.
The number of instruments that you have to get at once.
And speaking of, or I'm getting ahead of myself, but the first movement of the piano concerto is being released to the Kickstarter backers. And it's getting mailed out right now on CD, and they got their MP3 of it last month.
This is the Dragon Amnesty project that you're working on, right?
Yes, and it started out. I thought I was going to do a piece that was more reminiscent of my Dragon Ball Z, and it kind of starts that way. The composition kind of took over. My creative juices were flowing, and it just sort of got bigger than I thought it was going to be. And so I had an opening to the piece that didn't even have piano in it. And about a third of the way through, the piano started to take over the whole piece. So I thought, okay, if this is turned into a piano concerto, I've got to start the piece with the piano. So I kept everything that was there as kind of an underpinning and came up with this piano part to open the whole piece.
So I'm actually I have a couple of questions about Dragon Amnesty coming up as well. But before that, I want to ask you, just going back, you know, when you first started music, was there any particular piece of music or something that you had seen via theater, film, or television that wanted you to pick up an instrument, wanted you to compose?
My first recollection was going to the Philadelphia Orchestra as a second or third grader.
Okay.
And we heard Carnival of the Animals. So that was really cool. And of course, then a few years later, when I was 10 years old, I started piano lessons. My teacher was doing the music theory thing where you have the little staff book with staff lines and, you know, write out quarter notes and half notes and eighth notes and stuff and time signatures and key signatures. And that was kind of boring. And I thought, that's not what this is for. This is the stuff that people put the music on.
Yeah.
So I started writing little pieces. And if I practiced all my lesson, she'd let me play my pieces in the last 5 minutes of my lesson. So that went on for a couple of years. And then I picked up trumpet in junior high school. For us in America, that is the seventh and eighth grades.
Okay.
And so that's the seventh and eighth year in school. So seventh and eighth grade, I picked up the trumpet. And just before that, I had bought a bugle. I had bought a bugle and learned how to play the bugle. And so it's like picking up the trumpet was a natural extension. And then I started taking trumpet lessons and continued my piano lessons. So my piano lessons went from, you know, one teacher to the next. And when I was at the end of junior high, I started with a a really excellent college-based professor of piano who was giving me and a friend of mine piano lessons. And we would go there on Saturdays and spend the whole Saturday. He would even make lunch for us. And in the mornings, one of us would practice, the other one would have a lesson, like an hour to an hour and a half lesson. And then we would have lunch, and then we would listen to music. And so he introduced me to all kinds of music. And it's like I heard this Stravinsky's Rite of Spring when I was in the eighth or ninth grade, and I thought, oh, this is noise. I just couldn't even put my hands around it or my head. And now it's one of my favorite pieces of all time. But that first time hearing it, I must have been experiencing it like the people in 1912 did.
Yeah.
And they broke out in a riot because, you know, it was so noisy and rambunctious to them. And another high point was when I was a ninth grader and my band director let me write a piece for band and then taught me how to conduct. So I did that in a spring concert. The seniors were definitely jealous.
What age were you again? Sorry, seventh grade or
This was ninth grade.
Ninth grade
for freshmen in high school doing the band piece. So I was like 13, 14. And then I went off to, after doing, you know, 4 years of high school, I went to college.
Right.
And I started out as an aerospace engineer.
Oh, okay.
To make my parents wanted me to go into scientific. Right. And so I could make money. I guess. So I tried that for a semester. But during that time, I had piano lessons with a professor of piano that was teaching piano majors, and I had trumpet lessons with the professor of trumpet that was doing the trumpet principals who were majoring in trumpet, and I auditioned for the symphonic wind ensemble, which was the elite wind ensemble for the school. Most of the people in there were music majors, and here I was an aerospace engineering major, but I got to be one of the five trumpets in the wind ensemble, and I moved between first and second trumpet, which is like you have three cornet parts and two trumpet parts when you're doing a wind ensemble type instrumentation. It's kind of like the orchestra of bands, but no strings. And so it's like very few players on each part. And so I did that clear through my undergraduate degree, my master's degree, and I finally stopped it at the beginning of my doctorate. But I really enjoyed playing in that constantly. And I took piano lessons and trumpet lessons all the way through master's degree.
Wow.
But I get ahead of myself. So second semester of my freshman college year, I went to the director of the theory composition department, and I had my little briefcase, which was a 3-inch wide Samsonite plastic briefcase that had all my compositions I'd written since I was 10 years old. And I showed him, you know, some of the music.
The full portfolio.
Yeah. I fast forwarded to my best work, my most recent work.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, if you like my music, let me take the placement test or the final exam to Freshman Theory 101A. So he let me do that. And I got like a 99 out of 100 on the final exam in a course that I hadn't even taken. So I became a music major, and my parents were fine with that because I had tried the other. It was a good thing, though, that I did the engineering, because I took an engineering drawing. And when I did that, my manuscript skills improved light years. And this is pre-computer, so you had to handwrite your manuscripts.
Right. Actually, currently, I'm also like I'm learning what do you say, sheet music writing, and I have been learning music for the past 5 years, like theory and piano. But yeah, one thing that's stumped me is just the speed of generally writing, even per bar. But yeah, so I know what you mean. Yeah, just you have to get into that kind of rhythm and that pattern.
So in college, I had all kinds of orchestral works, many won prizes. My doctoral dissertation won a prize with the Elkhart Symphony. One of my master's pieces won a prize with the Fort Worth Symphony. First prize in that, in both of those. I had a saxophone and percussion piece that won a world prize with the World Saxophone Congress that was held in Toronto that year in, it's going to date me, early 70s, I want to say. I think it was 1972.
So I wanted to ask you another question based on that. So, fast forwarding a bit, what was the first project that you did, like a film or television project that you composed for and like you had gotten credit for? Because I'm sure like at in the beginning, everyone has to do that little bit of work and not get credit for something or something like that. So, which was the one that really did stick, for you?
Well, in between that, what I would have to tell you something. What really cemented me being as a composer, of course, I went through all my 3 degrees with composition major, and then I had a postdoctoral fellowship at Ohio State, where I was a composer in residence for 2 years. So all I had to do was go into my offices at Ohio State in Columbus, Ohio, and write music. And so I wrote a bunch of music. And I had a flute sonata for piano and flute, and a trumpet concerto, some songs for soprano and piano based on Emily Dickinson. And then I had a National Endowment for the Arts grant and an Ohio Arts Council grant, wrote some brass pieces. And after all of that, I started to just do composition on my own and moved back down to Dallas and was commissioned to do a piece for the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. And that's called Washington on the Brazos. That was in celebration of the Texas sesquicentennial, 150 years. And so it's a symphonic tone poem. And it was played by the Dallas Symphony and Lamar Symphony played it, and Mesquite Symphony Orchestra. I got to conduct it. That was a lot of fun to conduct it. Has always been a fun thing to do.
Actually, I wanted to ask you the Washington on the Brazos. Is there any like actual studio recording available of it, or has it only been performed live?
I have it performed live with the Dallas Symphony and the San Antonio Symphony. The San Antonio Symphony took it on tour. I think I have a Mesquite and a Lamar recording, but I guess my favorite recording is the San Antonio Symphony because they played it with such heart, and they played it with gusto. And I felt like the Dallas Symphony played it a little bit safer because they didn't want to make mistakes. But there were places where they played it slower than I wanted, or whereas the San Antonio Symphony played it more in the how I had thought of it tempo wise.
The right articulations.
Yeah, they made some mistakes though. I mean, it wouldn't stand as a studio recording because there's too many mistakes. But it would need to be practiced and, that kind of thing.
All right.
So after Washington on the Brazos, and during that time, I was starting to knock on doors and do music for various videos and films, commercials. I did eventually transition into doing stuff for PBS. And so I did music for some of their documentaries and some of their special event shows, like presidential debates. And then they had this documentary on tornadoes. And the guy who I worked with on that called me later on, and he was working on a television show called Your New House with Michael Holligan. So I did music for that for like 10 years. And one day while I was working on a PBS balloon documentary, I got this telephone call from somebody who said that they were the owners of Dragon Ball Z. It turned out to be Gen Fukunaga, and I'm talking with Gen about doing music for Dragon Ball Z, the show on Cartoon Network. And he asked, had I seen it? And I said, well, no, I haven't seen it, but I think my young son watches that. And so that conversation in early 99.
Oh, 99. Okay.
98.
Oh, okay.
98. It was being played in the Japanese version. The producers tried to do something in 1994. And I'm possibly getting my year wrong. When did I start that? 99 in February, was that the call? I know that it premiered in September of 99. Yeah, it had to be 1999 in February.
Okay.
Because I was just starting in late 98, I had just started the design and the building of Cake Mix.
Okay.
And so it was an incredible, wonderful thing that, you know, I'm getting this studio going and I'm getting this huge project going. So I had Your New House and I had Dragon Ball Z to look ahead to.
Your New House is a reality show, right? Is it, or is it a...
Yeah, it was one of the first do-it-yourself reality home shows.
Okay.
On how to remodel your house, how to get a loan for your house, how to, you know, update your appliances, those kind of things.
The real life home improvement.
Yeah, it was one of the very first.
Yeah. Wow.
And then several other self-help kind of shows.
Okay.
And eventually I did Lady Death, the sound for Lady Death, the motion picture, which is an anime feature film. And then feature film, like I did music and sound for The Bystander Theory, which is a feature film featuring my music.
That was in 2013 or something, right? 2015, sorry. Bystander Theory?
Yeah. Or 2015. Thanks. It starts to just fade away there. Yeah, and it's one of my, it's the 11th soundtrack. I have 9 Dragon Ball Z soundtracks. The 10th one is TV music soundtrack. And then is The Bystander Theory. And I have Scenes in the Dark. Have you seen that one?
Scenes in the Dark. I think I heard it. Actually, all of this is also on your Spotify, right? I think Scenes in the Dark, I was hearing a couple of tracks. Yeah.
You can see pictures of all the albums on Spotify. You can also see them on Amazon Music and iTunes. And you get them purely as a single unit when you go to those sites.
Yeah.
Scenes in the Dark is a musical play that was a feature film that won the first prize in the Houston Film Festival. So it was a musical play within a feature film, and the story was about a Renaissance composer, actor, playwright who is picking himself up from a nosedive in his career by creating a musical play about his life story.
Oh, okay.
So it was very interesting to
That's
work
kind of
with
meta.
David Arthur, the producer.
Yeah, that's quite a meta story right there. I mean, like a concept, very meta concept.
Yeah, and there's a lot of wonderful piano music in there and some orchestral music and songs. Recently, I've been doing A Little Spark, which is a children's book with Chris Parsons, who we've been co-writing songs. He's mainly the lyricist, and I'm mainly the composer, but we work together writing the songs. And he has come up with this wonderful story, and he's working on book two right now. Book one came out last year, and the book has those QR codes, and you put your phone on the QR code, and it calls up the song while you're reading the book, and you can read the book, listen to the song, sing along with the song. So 12 songs for the first book, and there's going to be about 12 songs for the second book.
Okay, so is another project you recently did was Red Planet Blues, which is one track, or is it?
Oh, there's a whole, that's another release. I did that with Carol Singer, who's the lyricist, and we released on a soundtrack, I forget how many of the songs, and it's a claymation story that she was working on. She has shorts right now, about three or four shorts that are between 3 to 15 minutes long that incorporate the music. Some very beautiful music in that as well, and some inspiring kid songs and songs for everybody. I'm particularly in love with the song I called Hero, You Are My Hero.
Ah, yeah.
Or
I think it's on
Hand
the
to
list
My
too.
Heart. I think the subtitle might be Hand to My Heart.
Yeah, this these latest projects, actually, how did you I mean, it's curious to me. How did you get a hold of Lil Spark, and like, who approached you to do these songs to compose for these?
Oh, the Lil Spark people?
Lil Spark,
With Chris Parsons?
Yeah.
Chris came in one day and talked with Lisa, my better half, and he came in like he had just done a bicycle ride. So he was in his bicycle shorts and his you know, workout tennis shoes and everything, and started talking about his book. This is several years ago, and he sort of described the songs, and then I had a meeting with him, and we were just going to do like one song. He wanted to try me out, and it turned out we worked really, really well together. And so one song became three songs, became five songs, it became 12 songs. And now we're in their second set of songs.
Yeah.
And we've done like five of the second set.
So did he approach you with the lyrics already written, or was it like a kind of collaborative effort with the lyrics?
He approached me with some of the lyrics, and sometimes he might have a little bit of an idea that he might sing a little example, and I would interpret the example, and we would create a piece of music from it. And so I would end up making the music out of it and the accompaniment and everything, and we would work together. But he provided the lyrics because he's the writer of the story too, and the novelist, the writer of the book.
Yeah.
So, and of course, it's a picture book because it's for a younger audience.
Yeah.
And he has a illustrator on the team as well. But we definitely would sit together, and I would sing and play what I had come up with. Sometimes it would come really fast, and sometimes it would come really slow. this last song, I thought about it for a month. And okay. It was like I rolled over the lyrics. I'd start out by just speaking the lyrics and getting a sense of them and a little bit of whatever scrap of tune there might be.
Yeah.
But then the tune would like grow, and it's like, well, how am I going to create an accompaniment to this? What is it? What's the musical orchestra going to be?
Yeah.
And so it all just sort of stews around in your imagination, and then finally it came out, and so I wrote it all out in a few days, and then it's the task of making verses and choruses all fit together and flow nicely and come up with a pleasing ending. Looking forward to that coming out. We have a couple of singles that have come out in the meantime too, like Dancing in the Woods and Believe in Me.
Yeah.
I think those just were released. I don't know if you saw those.
Yeah, Believe in Me I've heard. I didn't know there were additional pieces yet to come out.
Yeah, right. And Dragon Amnesty, I'm not sure if the Piano Concerto Movement 1 is out yet or not, but it's supposed to be out pretty soon digitally.
Is that okay? So recently actually I saw a picture of all the CDs. Through your Kickstarter campaign, you had burnt CDs for the backers, right? Dragon Amnesty.
Oh, right. Yeah, they just arrived. They decided that because it was a classical piece, I had to include my middle name.
Oh,
and
okay.
For the past 25, 30 years, I've never, hardly ever used my middle name on credit to one of my pieces.
Was it ever like, it wasn't even like Bruce L. Faulkner for anything before?
Sometimes on my symphonic pieces, I might have had Bruce L. Faulkner. And so they said, well, you have to have your whole name in there. And so we had to kick back all the graphics to the graphic designer, Tristan, and he did a great job. And then they heard the piece, and they kicked it back again to Lisa and said, wait a minute, you haven't given any credit to the orchestra players on the concerto. And Lisa says, well, Bruce played all the parts.
Oh, is it?
And it's like, it's like, why are you kicking it back for that? It's okay. I played all the parts because I couldn't afford to hire an orchestra.
Oh, I see.
If I'd hired an orchestra, that would have been really expensive.
Okay.
Upwards of $20,000+ to get, somebody like members of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, for example, or
especially during this time. Especially during this time, I don't know what the rates would be like. Or
and so, I used my samples. I got an updated version of Digital Performer, and the East West Library. Boy, they should pay me for these plugs. I'm not being paid for those plugs, but. I used their sound library on the new Digital Performer,
okay,
and made a transition, and it was pretty wild because the first half of Dragon Amnesty was composed on my old system with my old sounds, and then I added in the new computer, and I wanted to use both to play at the same time. And so I locked both systems together with time code so that my old system and my new system are playing together in the Dragon Amnesty piece.
Oh, okay. So actually, I wanted to ask you, Dragon Amnesty, a couple of years ago, you had done an interview with a YouTuber named Blackenfist. And there actually you were speaking about an upcoming tribute in the same vein of Dragon Ball Z, the style of Dragon Ball Z, a tribute to the fans. By any chance, is Dragon Amnesty that tribute project, or is this a separate thing?
Yes, it actually is.
Okay.
And it's like, finally, the pandemic hit, and it's like, okay, what am I going to do with myself? I need to be really seriously writing. And so we started the Kickstarter campaign to help out. And that was a chore in itself. I could have written an entire composition in what it took to do the Kickstarter campaign. But thankfully, Lisa, my better half, she was very helpful in everything that she did in creating the campaign. I went in one day and started that just kind of like I started Dragon Ball Z with just writing out a little core idea, which later on becomes, you know, many
theme
things.
Song or...
Yeah, like the Dragon Ball Z theme song, which became SSJ3 and several other pieces in Dragon Ball Z are based on it.
So actually, I wanted to ask you, based on that, so, today the soundtrack that you did for Funimation Studios is, you know, quite, like, it's considered, like, really quite the primary soundtrack of Dragon Ball Z. It has a lot of those themes that kind of aggressive mood to, that really fits the action. So you did, I think, over 200 episodes worth of music, right? So was there ever any doubt, like, initially when you were planning, like, what style you wanted to have the soundtrack be? Was there any alternative style that was in your head?
I started with episode 67 and a half, 68.
Okay.
Because they were editing at the time and truncating the shows. So the English version was like version 54, was episode 54, but it was really episode 68. And I went clear through to episode 291. So the only episodes I didn't do were the first episodes, 1 through 67.
Yeah.
And I spoke with the producers and the director for the show, and we talked style. I gave them musical examples of my work and played ideas and talked style. And I also understood that because of this epic nature of the show, 291 episodes is huge. And I wanted to do something that took the whole show and made it a cohesive, complete work inspired by Richard Wagner and Richard Strauss. The idea of leitmotifs, which represented characters, ideals, landscapes, imagery, moods, feelings. Wagner weaves these leitmotifs all through his operas, as Strauss does through his symphonic poems. And that was what I wanted to do with the characters and their situations. So that is part of the core of unity that holds the whole series together. And then when we came through different characters being the predominant, I felt like one style did well for Goku. And then kind of a slightly different style for Trunks. And we talked, the director and I talked about Trunks being more in the future. So I said, well, what about techno music, incorporating a little bit of the essence of techno into that? And when Cell was going on, it's like I envisioned a leitmotif of Cell starts out as this very simple form, and he grows and grows and grows. And so as each character came along, discussions about how the music would track the individuality of the character were fundamentally important. And then they just left me alone to to basically do what I would conceive.
Yeah, because every character basically has their own theme, their own transformation theme as well, which I thought was very, very... like, it worked so well if you watch the whole series. And when those themes come back up, there's this certain level of, like, goosebumps you get when you hear the theme before the action happens.
Thank you. Oh, one thing, too, is when we initially started talking, the director and the producer and I, it was Barry Watson was the producer at the time and director. Daniel Kokenauer and Gen Fukunaga were the executive producers.
Okay.
And they wanted wall-to-wall music. That's sort of a slang term, which means they wanted music from the beginning to the end of each episode. No stops. So what that presented for me was a challenge, because in a piece, in a show, an episode, you've got dialogue, sound effects, action, scenes, up close dialogue, farther away dialogue, and so if you're going to have music all the way through, the music needs to do something that follows all of this. And what more than an opera would describe what happens in a show, TV show with wall-to-wall music?
Yeah.
Would be the way, the only thing that didn't happen was they didn't sing until I got Meredith McCoy, who was the voice of Android 18, to do a song with me. She wrote the lyrics and we co-wrote that song. The Android 18 album. So it's like a love story with Android 18 and Krillin.
Yeah.
So anyway, wall-to-wall music. So some places the dialogue needs to be right out there.
Yeah.
And some places the music is out there because it's just action.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I'd have to fight with him about mixing with the sound effects, because the music is more powerful than the sound effects.
Yeah, it is.
If you let the music speak, the sound effects can be softer and still carry weight. Yeah. But if you make the music too soft, you don't get all that emotional attachment that you can with the music just there.
And it is quite operatic in many ways. It is quite operatic in the sense that the music soars even in the background during the contemplative dialogue scenes, where the music just goes on. And yeah, you're right, because like the sound effects don't add anything more to the emotion after a point, whereas the music really elevates that along with the character situations in that scene.
Yeah. So I would look at the script, I would follow the story, and then I would, in detail, study how the video episode was put together, frame by frame. And so it becomes like a choreography of how the action is going on. If somebody gets punched, that becomes documented in the storyline of the video edits, and using time code, taking the time code and collaborating with the musical tempo and the kind of piece it's going to be mood-wise, and that all churns together, and then you end up with something that's mathematically ordered, and perhaps some scene then gives you an inspiration for a fragment of music, and then it just unfolds from there.
Yeah.
So that's the general process, and it's part of what makes a lot of the scenes so powerful, is they're visually powerful, the acting is powerful, and the music follows what's going on.
Yeah. Actually, thing is that Dragon Ball Z, right? Just to delve a little deep into my past, my brother and I actually were huge fans of Dragon Ball Z right from when we were like, I was, I think, 7 or 8 years old at the time. I don't know whether that's too young to watch the show, but like I was 7 or 8 watching it.
You survived.
Yeah. But I mean, all for the best, because that was the show actually that really made me want to delve deeper into like, why does this theme like get stuck in my head? Why are the visuals also like simultaneously getting stuck in the head because of the music? And I noticed that with the from Dragon Ball Z onwards, actually, it was something, as you mentioned also, the music kind of, you know, lurking in the background while, you know, dialogues going on or some, you know, pivotal scenes. I noticed that with Dragon Ball Z, particularly the Cell Saga, a lot of the styles that came in the Cell Saga as well was something that made me very interested in, like, wow, this is a mix of orchestral, but it also goes techno, but at times you also have very aggressive elements of like hard rock and metal. So yes,
heavy metal, right?
Yeah, I was wondering like how did that come about, like fusing, you know, heavy metal with it, because I thought it really worked
well. Even the theme, Goku's theme, has the distorted guitars in it.
Yeah.
But then we just get even more so with the crazy characters in that saga, the metal seemed to fit very well too, and set them apart from everybody else, because they were kind of zany characters.
Yeah,
a lot of the time they were the bad guys.
Bad guys turned good on multiple occasions.
And yeah. It was just exploiting another musical style to help continue the arc and yet keep the themes, the essence of the intervallic relationships of the themes going as kind of a transformation of those characters.
Now, I know you probably won't be able to like tell like what your favorite track is from the series, because you've done so much music, but I'm wondering if there was any saga or character that you really loved composing for.
Well, I like Goku and I like Android 18, so probably my favorite pieces that I could, the opening theme and its many variations and permutations of becoming other songs. I'll safely go with that one, because between it and SSJ3, it seems to be the number one on Spotify all the time.
Yeah, it is.
So
yeah,
I guess there's a wrestler who uses the SSJ3 for his coming out music.
Is it?
Which kind of, I saw that on on Twitter. It kind of cracked me up. It was in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah, but music and, like that really...
I love Android.
Music like that really does get you pumping quite a bit, because even me, like I've noticed with a lot of people, I mean, including a lot of my friends and all, it's that music that you want to listen to motivate yourself, just in general situations, or if you're working out, it's really like that type of music that really gets you going and gets you thinking positively.
Mm-hmm. Android 18 is another one of my favorites, because I always wanted to write a piece that incorporated serial music, which is also known as 12-tone music. I wrote a lot of 12-tone music when I was early in college as part of my composition classes. But fast forward into, you know, writing for television, I always wanted to write a 12-tone piece that was accessible to the popular audience. And so I created this techno 12-tone piece with Meredith McCoy's lyrics. And it was like a fusion of 12-tone serial music and popular music, techno music, coming together. And so that was a very fun thing. And I think people really enjoy it. I played it for Kamehameha Con last summer. And and I talked about the piece and its construction at Kamehacon, and it was really well received, and happily one of the audience members actually filmed the entire conversation I had as my talk at Kamehacon. So that's available on YouTube.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Actually. Yeah, that's the thing actually. Many of these cons, sadly, I'm in India, so many of these like Kamehacon or a lot of those kind of cons don't really happen here. And I was wondering actually if I were at a con and you were there, I want to ask. So earlier you had mentioned Wagner and Strauss being huge influences on the more subtler pieces of music and kind of the more softer ones, right? So, like, for example, the hyperbolic time chamber scenes, those actually are very, very synth-based.
Right.
So the synth-based, did this come about also like you wanted to... have that be just techno, because it's like a very good mix of techno and orchestral. So
the samplers that I had at the time were the Roland, the Emulator E2, a Proteus 1 and a Proteus 2, and particularly the Alesis 6 was mainstay core instrument for Dragon Ball Z, interesting sounds. And so I had this orchestra setup of all these different instruments and a fusion between orchestra and synth sounds, driven by a core percussion. I always did all the percussion tracks. None of those are loops or anything like that. This is pre-loop anyway.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Every drum beat is put out there one instrument at a time. I also had an octopad, and I would play on the octopad, but not being a drummer, that's a little bit harder to perform with.
That was one thing, actually, that I connected with initially when I was listening to the soundtrack, because I've actually been playing the drums since I was about 8 years old, and the more faster tracks of the series, I was constantly trying to break down, like, what... drum was used for this, what drum was used for that, but then I didn't have an understanding then that, like, oh wait, these could have been, say, plugins, or these could have been digital, you know.
It was like treating it like a trap set. So you have your kick drum, your snare, toms, both electric toms and acoustic toms, and those electric were kind of almost rototom-ish. You know what a rototom is?
Rototom? No, I'm not sure, actually.
A set of anywhere from 3 to 5, and they're tunable, and they look like the top of a snare drum.
Huh.
And they're more like treated like a tom-tom.
Oh, okay.
Like your floor toms. But it's a smaller set. They're kind of like the tenor and treble of the floor toms.
Okay, and then, more higher pitched.
Then hi-hats and crash cymbal and ride cymbal. And just trying to play it as realistically as a drummer as possible.
Yeah. One thing's for sure is, like, it definitely sounded large. So I'm sure the production process itself, the mix and the master, would have been quite a task.
When you hear Dragon Amnesty, I really wanted it to sound like a real symphony orchestra. And yet it also has things like space voices and one of my other favorite things back from my Emulator 2 was my Liquid STK patch, which is a combination of kind of a vocal and a heavy attacked string instrument that's really sustaining. But it was really a focus on this full 60 to 70 instruments in the orchestra.
Okay. So Dragon Amnesty actually, currently copies have been sent to the backers. Would it, when would it be like publicly available, like on a Spotify or something?
Very soon. We're dealing with the logistics of mailing it out right now, because people have awards from pledging. So we have a Dragon Amnesty t-shirt, Android 18 vocal manuscript. There's a short piece I did, about a minute and a half piece, for High Voltage, which is a very, a very Dragon Ball Z like style. That's, you can hear part of that and see a video of that producer's and animator's story. If you go to the Kickstarter, there's a video that plays, a little tease of the idea of some of the new music I'm going to do. I'm also going to do another Dragon Ball Z tribute piece, since my Dragon Amnesty piece turned into a piano concerto. I'm going to do something that my Dragon Ball Z fans will recognize more as a Dragon Ball Z like crafted style of music. I still have to do that one. I'm going to do that sometime, I hope, in the next 6 months or so. I have to give myself time, because I'm practicing the second movement of the piano concerto and finishing the orchestration, and I still have to write the third movement, which is going to be challenging, because I really want that to... I'm looking at all these pillars of classical music, and if you're writing a piano concerto, you don't want it to suck.
Aside from Dragon Amnesty, currently, are you also writing something else for another project?
Well, the songs for Chris are a huge thing. So we're about to start another one, I think. And those in themselves are very... Finishing the orchestration of the piano concerto is enormous amount of extra work. And I've produced a couple of pieces for singer-songwriters who come in the studio. One of my favorites came back two Fridays ago, Brian Yingling, and he did a couple of new songs, which we're still producing and adding. He's a guitarist and a singer and songwriter. So he did the guitar parts and the bass part. And so I still have to add other things like the drums and other keyboards and things, backup vocals. So I am working on that too, as time permits.
I wanted to ask, I wanted to actually kind of deviate slightly in our conversation. I wanted to ask you, so the music industry, especially the way we listen to music in general, is changing quite a bit. And, you know, everything is going, I mean, everything is already streaming. And however, vinyl has really picked up over the past 5-6 years, the printing of vinyl and people wanting that kind of collectible physical item. But I wanted you know, I wanted to know, where do you stand on the argument of, like, what's the best way to listen to music?
The best way is acoustically. Go to the orchestra, go to the opera, go to the chamber music performance, and listen to them live.
Yeah.
Second best is on a good stereo system, and the trouble with vinyl or records, we used to call them records. They call them vinyl now. Is that they're so scratchy. Whereas the CDs are so pristine and yet so digital. So it's hard to say. I like essence of both. Reel to reel tape was pretty cool when you had noise reduction coupled with it. That was probably the best, because it was magnetic based. And
this is what you was what were you saying? Tape.
Reel-to-reel tape.
Reel-to-reel tape. Oh, okay,
With noise reduction.
So that didn't... I mean, obviously, that wouldn't have the crackling and the popping of a record. no. played on a gramophone.
Not quite as much, unless it was badly recorded. If it was well recorded, a reel-to-reel with noise reduction was really pristine. But now with this technology like I just got, with these pristine mic pres going digital with whatever sample rate you want to go, it's really sounding pretty phenomenal.
Wonderful.
Into the digital technology. So as it gets more and more resolution, those little gaps that the numbers can't duplicate are getting filled in.
Yeah. So I wanted to now move on to the final round of questions, which these are pretty quick ones. And it's so I call this round the Maximum Gain Questionnaire, based on my podcast, the Maximum Gain Podcast. So this is where I ask you questions so the audience would get to know the person behind the art we all love a little better. So the first question is, if you weren't a composer by profession, what do you see yourself being if you weren't a composer or a sound engineer by profession?
Well, I spoke a little earlier on that and kind of gave away
the question.
Because I was an aerospace engineer. I had a scholarship. I was thinking about becoming a pilot.
Oh, okay.
And in order, my childhood dream was to be an astronaut. Go figure.
Yeah.
How many kids didn't have that dream?
Yeah.
But then I sat down at the piano when I was 10, and it was like, wow, this is really cool. And it was just joy all the time through my childhood. And so it was like hard to think of doing anything else, but I loved math. I loved when I was an assistant professor, loved teaching. I was teaching music, of course, because I had changed from aerospace engineering, but I loved chemistry. When I was a little kid, I had a chemistry set, and the under part of my bathroom sink, I had my laboratory. So I'd open up the bottom underneath the sink, and I had all my chemicals and my test tubes, I did experiments. That was back when they actually had real chemistry sets. Nowadays, chemistry sets for kids, like, oh no, the product liability.
Yeah.
They don't do chemistry sets anymore because it's too dangerous. So how are they going to develop scientists? I don't know.
That's why when you mentioned those laboratory sets and stuff, I wasn't really familiar with that. I was like wondering what sets you're talking about, like, because that's something that has kind of been eradicated from the century entirely.
Yeah, it's horrible. you lose chemists who are going to be geniuses. The other thing I liked doing was building models, and I built a clipper ship from scratch and I drew it out on paper and got it to where it would actually work in a water setting and everything. And it had four masts and it was about 3 feet long. So I enjoyed working that way with wood, but my passion was always music.
Aerospace engineer music, and you chose music.
Yeah, and they didn't ask me to be an astronaut, so
okay.
So I stuck with music.
So, okay, what would you say would be your favorite hobby?
I like to cook all kinds of cuisine. My wife cooks Indian food better than I do, so I let her do the Indian food, but sometimes I help. But I like all different cuisines, Japanese, Cajun, French, American. Okay.
You take
German.
You take spice well.
Oh yeah. I'll do like maybe a 3 on Indian food. I don't want to get too out of there. But I like Thai and Chinese, and it's all an adventure, and it feels like I'm connecting with the culture and Mexican food too. And Tex-Mex. We're in Texas here. So there's Tex-Mex, which is a fusion of Texas and Mexican food, and then there's the cuisine from Mexico, which I love too, to cook the actual dishes from different regions of Mexico is a joy. And a week doesn't go by we have Mexican food at least once a week, and we have Indian food at least a couple of times a month.
Oh, wow. Okay. Nice. Yeah. Is there any... okay, so moving on to the next question. Is there any existing movie you would have loved to give your own spin on the score for?
Wow. Some of the movies that I really admire are like Gladiator, Lord of the Rings, Master and Commander, and of course Game of Thrones and...
Right.
And the Star Wars stuff.
Yeah.
And Diary of a Geisha. I thought John Williams did a great job of Diary of a Geisha.
Memoirs of a Geisha.
Memoirs of a Geisha. Thank you. Very, very wonderful score. I love that that music that he did. The movies that are memorable are the ones that I admire the score more so than... Yeah. And I think I could have done a better job. But there's some that I sort of commiserate with the composer, like Willow. I don't know if you remember Willow.
It's an 80s movie or something, right? Like it's an old...
possibly, yeah. It's an adventure fantasy movie. And it's a situation where when they're doing the editorial of the film... They oftentimes have a temp track, which is a temporary
piece of music
that's going to be replaced.
Some other source.
And the composer's going to do a new piece. But the editor needs something to edit to.
Yeah.
Well, the director falls in love with the temp track, and he goes, I want something like that. And so the opening of Willow is this Schumann Symphony number 3, the Rhenish. But it's convoluted out of its real manifestation. If you listen to the Schumann Rhenish Symphony number 3 first movement, and then you listen to the opening of Willow, you go, wait a minute, what have they done with the score? It's sort of Schumann, but it's more. I forget if it's James Horner who did that or who, but it's more like, this is how I'm going to please the director, and I'm going to use this piece and make it, you know, work for the film.
Yeah.
So very, very interesting. It's one of, that's one that kind of always stuck out with me is like, oh, please don't fall in love with the temp track because I can do something that's so much more expressive for you.
Yeah, and actually, I'm so glad you brought up a temp track thing because I remember doing... so I've composed for a few short films and a few projects over the past 2-3 years. And multiple times I've come into the same problem of the director being in love with his or her version of the film, the edit. And they're like, oh, look, what's the edit without the music that I made? And it's a track from... You know, it's a track from some other movie entirely. And I'm like, no, that wasn't what I was thinking. That style wasn't what I was thinking, but I had the emotion in place and everything. And then they get very attached to that. So I totally understand. So it's kind of like a frustrating thing.
You have to shake it off like a dog who's just fallen in the water and gets out. He shakes all that water off. Yeah. And you got to just shake it off and focus on being creative. Especially in those times, and you have to kind of like respect the director's thoughts and then try to respect your own thoughts and fuse those two together and come up with something new.
So I just wanted to ask you another thing. So speaking of, you had mentioned, shaking water off or like a dog. Are you a dog or a cat person or any other animal, for example?
I have a crazy red poodle. He's before him I had a more sedated cream colored and they're both standard poodles, and it's like each one has their own personality. And I love dogs. This guy sports his red hair with a kind of a red hair disposition, and he thinks he's the leader of the pack. Mm. And I have to remind him, like, no, you're the dog. I'm the alpha.
Okay, literally so, leader of the family, like the dog was thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you're not the leader of the family. I am. So get over it. But that was him as a puppy, and he's mellowed out as a 3-year-old.
Hmm.
So he's a great dog. Yeah, I'm a dog person.
Nice. Okay. Can you name a book that you highly revere?
Well, the Bible, of course, and then other books. I like the Lord of the Rings series because I managed to read through the whole thing.
Oh wow!
It's probably one of my favorites,
including the Silmarillion. I think that's one of the books.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was the fourth book I read. I'm not as much of a reader as my sons, who are both avid readers. Because I do that with music, and so I like to discover all the piano music that there is out there from the many, many composers over the centuries and all the different kinds of styles from Baroque, classical, Renaissance, Romantic, 20th century, and all of its different styles. My composers that I like are people like Bartok and Stravinsky, Debussy and Ravel, Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, Mozart, Borodin, Tchaikovsky.
Okay.
I just love all the music. Back to Gesualdo in the Renaissance. Mm. And Palestrina in the Renaissance.
Okay. The thing is, what's funny is like, I'm not really familiar with many of the composers you just mentioned, but a lot of modern day music, like music from movies like Signs or The Omen, have actually gotten me appreciating classical music a lot more. I don't know if you've seen The Omen or Signs, or Jerry Goldsmith's score for The Omen.
I admire Goldsmith's work too. Jerry Goldsmith's a great composer.
Yeah.
And there's several. I'm hyped up on classical music right now, thinking of those other composers for film that I love a lot are sort of in the back of my head right now. They'll come out after this interview.
Yeah.
And I'll go, oh, yeah, I wish I'd mentioned so-and-so. Do you get my Bruce Falconer Spotify channel in India?
Yeah, I do. So yeah, we do.
I hope that you and your followers and listeners would at least go there, and if they are able, go to Amazon or iTunes as well and explore my music. And
And there's a lot of stuff besides Dragon Ball Z that you've been a part of, that including the Bystander Theory soundtrack, which I thought was quite powerful. That's all on your Spotify. So yeah, cool. Definitely, I'd also suggest everyone listen to that.
The movie's worth watching too. It's a pretty good movie.
Where is it available, or at least in the States?
It should be available on Amazon.
Amazon, okay.
And I think you can stream it.
Yeah,
you can stream the movie.
Wonderful.
Also, I should mention, of course, the Kickstarter kind of campaign with Dragon Amnesty comes and goes because it has a set deadline. But I do have a Patreon.com.
Okay.
And I would invite anybody who wants to be a patron of my music and get the inside creative vibe for what I'm working on. They can become a member of my Patreon.com/ Bruce Falconer. That's pretty easy to find, I think, and you can also see it on my Facebook page from time to time, if you've noticed on my Facebook page.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, it's pretty easy to find.
I may have sent that to you on Instant Messenger.
Yeah, Yeah, I think you did. Yeah, and also it's easy to find on your, I think it's one of the pinned posts on Facebook, on your Facebook page.
I'm hoping a lot of people, I appreciate all the people who enjoy my music, and I'm hoping that throughout the world some of them will reach out, and the Patreon has multiple levels to make it easy to be, because it's about crowd. And I have people so far who've joined as far as New Zealand.
Wow. Okay. And India. So, I mean, like, I'm going to be, you know, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. You can be my ambassador for your country.
Please. Yes.
I appreciate talking with you today.
Yeah. Same here. I want to thank you so much for doing this interview. Hope you enjoyed it. A lot of interesting things we talked about. And yeah, I'm happy I got to know you a little bit better.
And please send me a copy when you finish.
Definitely. I'll be putting out small clips also, like besides the full thing on all streaming platforms, I'll be putting out small clips of this interview as well on Instagram. So I'll send that to you as well.
Very nice. And feel free to plug my my new music and my Patreon, which is funding my new music and everything.
Yeah. That's how the world works now. Everything goes around that cycle. Yeah.
And definitely. And thank you so much, Ari, for this podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for accepting to do this. It was fun.
Well, have a great week, and I look forward to hearing from you in the future.
Yeah, same here. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. See you.
Bye.
Hope you enjoyed the interview with Bruce Falconer. This was one that, as I said, was super fun to do. And I just need to thank Bruce. You know, I thanked him directly, but now I want to thank him indirectly. Thank you, Bruce, so much for doing this interview. It was amazing. And I've been, honestly, I didn't say this before, but I've been in contact with Bruce Falconer since 2018 through Facebook Messenger. And I felt brave one day. And I was like, I'm just going to message Bruce Falconer. And he actually replied days later, but he replied. And we had multiple exchanges in 2018, even 2019 and 2020, in fact. And then suddenly this year, I'm like, hey, Bruce, could you check out my music? I released an album, by the way, called Dukha. It's D-U-K-K-H-A, Dukha. It's on Spotify, by the way. Or anywhere you listen to music, it's on there. It's an instrumental orchestral album. I sent him a link and I asked him if it was possible, very politely, for him to listen to it. And he actually replied, yeah, sure, I'll listen to it. And he asked me where I studied and all that stuff. And it was super cool, you know, when your idol kind of interacts with you. And it was awesome. And then finally I asked him, hey, would you mind being on the podcast? And he said, yeah, sure. And it was awesome. And to have him on the show, it was just... It was perfect, honestly. I was very happy to have him on the show. I can't wait to get you all more episodes of Maximum Gain Podcast. Remember, this show, this podcast gives you not only interviews, but it gives you the Since 99 series, and it gives you Topically Speaking, which is a separate segment, a separate series, where I talk about one topic each episode. So one episode will talk about why I felt the 90s was the best decade for heavy metal, or one episode, the episode that's released right now is the one where I'm talking about 80s entertainment and why I hate 80s entertainment. You might want to check that one out. It's basically a rant, so it's fun, and you might take some stuff away from it. I get quite deep into why I feel the nostalgia of the 80s should disappear right now, because it's kind of getting toxic as well. Thank you all once again so much for listening. And as always, I hope you stay happy and I hope you stay safe.